believe Shaw in particular and Bakeley in Bakeley's year 1870. It was now possible to procure there pretty much anything you liked in Britain, which was a conveniency, because suppose anything was required of a servant, and he had no such thing before now, he, Elton, could step down there, supposing the shop to be still open, and order it in without he borrowed it of the rectory, whereas in earlier days it would have been useless to pursue such a course in respect of anything but candles, or soap, or treacle, or perhaps a penny child's picture book. And my heart out of ten, if it be something more in the nature of a bottle of whiskey you'd be requiring. Leastwise, on the whole, Humphreys thought he would be prepared for the book in future. The library was the obvious place for the after-dinner hours. Candle in hand and pipe in mouth, he moved round the room for some time, taking stock of the titles of the books. He had all the predisposition to take interest in an old library, and there was every opportunity for him here to make a systematic acquaintance with them, for he had learned from Cooper that there was no catalogue, save the very superficial one made for purposes of probate. The drawing up of a catalogue of his own would be a delicious occupation for Winter. There would probably be treasures to be found, too. Even manuscripts of Cooper might be trusted. As he pursued his round, the sense came upon him, as it does upon most of us in similar places, of the extreme unreadableness of a great portion of the collection. Editions of classics and fables and Picard's religious ceremonies and the Holleian mythology are supposed all very well, but who is ever going to read Tostatus Abulensis or Tornado on Jove or a book like this? He picked out a small quarto, loosened the binding, and from which the lettered label had fallen off, and observing that coffee was waiting for him, retired to a chair. Eventually he opened the book. It will be observed that his condemnation of it rested wholly on external grounds. For all he knew, it might have been a collection of unique plays, but undeniably the outside was blank and forbidden. As a matter of fact, it was a collection of sermons or meditations, and mutilated at that, for the first sheet was blank. It seemed to belong to the latter end of the 17th century. He turned over the pages till his eye was caught by a marginal note. A parable of this unhappy condition. And he thought one said the other. How he went the way you ought of, and was never seen more. All of such another, says the mother, that adventured himself but a little way in, and from that day forth is so troubled in his wits that he cannot tell what he saw, nor hath passed one good night. Have you never heard, cried the neighbor, of what faces have been seen to look out over the palisadoes and betwixt the bars of the gate? But all would not do. The man was set upon his purpose, for it seemed it was a common fireside talk of that country that at the heart and center of this labyrinth there was a jewel of such price and rarity that would enrich the finder thereof for new life, and this should be his by right that could persevere to come at it. What then? Quit Malta. The adventurer passed the gates, and for a whole day's space his friends without had no news of him, except it might be by some indistinct cries heard afar off in the night, such as made them turn in their restless beds and sweat for very fear, not doubting but that their son and brother had put one more to the catalogue of those unfortunates that had suffered shipwreck on that voyage. So the next day they went with weeping tears to the clerk of the parish to order the bell to be tolled, and their way took them hard by the gate of the labyrinth, which they would have hastened by from the horror they had of it, but that they caught sight of a sudden of a man's body lying in the roadway, and going up to it with what anticipation may be easily figured, found it be him whom they reckoned as lost, and not dead, though he were in a swoon most like death. They then, who had gone forth as mourners, came back rejoicing, and set to by all means to revive their prodigal, who, being come to himself and hearing of their anxieties and their errand of that morning, "Aye," says he, "you may as well finish what you are about, for all I have brought back the jewel," which he showed them, and 'twas indeed a rare piece, "I have brought back that with it that will leave me neither rest at night nor pleasure by day." Whereupon they were instant with him to learn his meaning, and where his company should be that went so sore against his stomach. "Oh," says he, "'tis here in my breast. I cannot flee from it, do what I may." So it needed no wizard to help them to a guess that it was the recollection of what he had seen that troubled him so wonderfully. But they could get no more of him for a long time but by fits and starts. However, at long and at last they made shift to collect somewhat of this kind, that at first, while the sun was bright, he went merrily on, and without any difficulty reached the heart of the labyrinth, and got the jewel, and so set out on his way back. wherein all the beasts of the forests do move, he began to be sensible of some creature keeping pace with him, and, as he thought, peering and looking upon him from the next alley to that he was in, and that when he should stop, his companion should stop also, which put him in some disorder of his spirits. And indeed, as the darkness increased, it seemed to him that there was more than one, and it might be even a whole band of such followers. At least, so he judged by the rustling and cracking that they kept among the thickets. Besides that, there would be at a time a sound of whispering, which seemed to import a conference among them. But in regard of who they were, or what form they were of, he would not be persuaded to say what he thought. Upon his hearers asking him what the cries were which they heard in the night, as was observed above, he gave them this account, that about midnight, so far as he could judge, he heard his name called from a long way off, and he would have been sworn it was his brother that so called him. So he stood still and hallooed at the pitch of his voice, and he supposed that the echo of the noise of his shouting disguised for the moment any lesser sound, because when there fell a stillness again, he distinguished a tramping, not loud, of running feet coming very close behind him, wherewith he was so daunted that himself set off to run, and that he continued till the dawn broke. Sometimes when his breath failed him, he would cast himself flat on his face and hope that his pursuers might overrun him in the darkness, but at such a time they would regularly make a pause, and he could hear them pant and snuff as it had been a hound at fault, which wrought in him so extreme a horror of mind that he would be forced to betake himself again, determining and doubling if by any means he might throw them off the scent. And as if this exertion was in itself not terrible enough, he had before him the constant fear of falling into some pit or trap of which he had heard, and indeed seen with his own eyes, that there were several, some at the sides and other in the midst of the alleys, so that, in fine, he said, a more dreadful night was never spent by mortal creature than that he had endured in that labyrinth, and not that jewel which he had in his wallet, nor the richest that was ever brought out of the Indies, could be a sufficient recompense to him for the pains he had suffered. I will spare to set down the further recital of this man's troubles, inasmuch as I am confident my reader's intelligence will hit the parallel I desire to draw. For is not this jewel a just emblem of the satisfaction which a man may bring back with him from a course of this world's pleasures? And will not the labyrinth serve for an image of the world itself, wherein such a treasure, if we may believe the common voice, is the writer's improvement of his parable might be left to itself. So he put the book back in its former place, wondering as he did so whether his uncle had ever stumbled across that passage, and if so, whether it had worked on his fancy so much as to make him dislike the idea of the maze, and determine to shut up the one in the garden. Not long afterwards, he went to bed. The next day brought him more in hard work with Mr. Cooper, who, if exuberant in language, had the business of the estate at his fingers' ends. He was very greedy, this long Mr. Cooper was, and not forgotten the order to clear out the maze. The work was going on at that moment. His girl was on her tentacles of expectation about it. He also hoped that Humphreys had swept the sleep of the dust, and that he should be favoured with a continuance of this congenial weather. At luncheon he enlarged on the pictures in the dining room, and pointed out the portrait of the constructor of the temple and the maze. Humphreys examined this with considerable interest. It was the work of an Italian, and had been painted when old Mr. Wilson was visiting Rome as a young man. There was indeed a view of the Colosseum in the background. A pale, thin face and large eyes were the characteristic features. In the hand was a partially unfolded roll of paper, on which could be distinguished the plan of a circular building, very probably the temple, and also part of that of a labyrinth. Humphreys got up on a chair to examine it, but it was not painted with sufficient clearness to be worth copying. It suggested to him, however, that he might as well make a plan of his own maze, and hang it in the hall for the use of visitors. This determination of his was confirmed that same afternoon, for when Mrs. and Miss Cooper arrived, eager to be inducted into the maze, he found that he was wholly unable to lead them to the centre. The guardian had removed the guide marks they had been using, and even Catherine, when summoned to assist, was as helpless as the rest. The point is, you see, Mr. Woods, I should say Humphreys, these mazes is purposely constructed so much alike with a view to mislead. Still, if you follow me, I think I can put you right. I'll just put my hand down here as a starting point. He stumped off, and after 5 minutes brought the party safe to the hat again. "Now, that's a very peculiar thing," he said with a sheepish laugh. "I made sure I'd left that hat just over against the bramble bush, and you could see for yourself there ain't no bramble bush, not in this walk at all. If you'll allow me, Mr. Humphreys, there's the name in it, sir. I'll just call one of the men in to mark the place like." William Cracker arrived in answer to repeated shouts. He had some difficulty in making his way to the party. First he was seen or heard in an inside alley, then, almost at the same moment, in an outer one. However, he joined them at last, and was first consulted without effect, and then stayed. simple. What we mean is taking out a couple of trees from each edge in a straight line so you get a clear view right through. Of course, that does away with it as a maze, but I don't know if you'd approve of that. No, I won't have that done yet. I'll make a plan first and let you have a copy. Later on, if we find occasion, I'll think of what you say. Humphreys was vexed and ashamed at the fiasco of the afternoon, and could not be satisfied without making another effort that evening to reach the centre of the maze. His irritation was increased by finding it without a single thought step. He had thoughts of beginning his plan at once, but the light was fading, and he felt that by the time he had got the necessary materials together, work would be impossible. Next morning, accordingly, carrying a drawing board, pencils, compasses, cartridge paper, and so forth, some of which had been borrowed from the Coopers and some found in the library cupboards, he went to the middle of the maze, again without any hesitation, and set out his materials. He was, however, delayed in making a start. The brambles and weeds that had obscured the column of globe were now all cleared away, and it was for the first time possible to see clearly what these were like. The column was featureless, resembling those on which sundials are usually placed. Not so the globe. I have said that it was finely engraved with figures and inscriptions, and that on a first glance Humphreys had taken it for a celestial globe, but he soon found that it did not answer to his recollection of such things. One feature seemed familiar, a winged serpent, Draco. Circled about the place which on a terrestrial globe is occupied by the equator, but on the other hand, a good part of the upper hemisphere was covered by the outspread wings of a large figure whose head was concealed by a ring at the pole or summit of the whole. Around the base of the head, the words trinket tenebrarum could be deciphered. Reader's note, trinket tenebrarum is the Prince of Darkness. End of reader's note. In the lower hemisphere there was a space patched all over with cross lines and marked as umbra mortis. Reader's note, the shadow of death. End reader's note. Near it was a range of mountains, and among them a valley with flames rising from it. This was lettered. Will you be surprised to learn it? Valles Filiorum Hymnum. Reader's note, the valley of the sons of Gehenna. End of reader's note. Above and below Draco were outlined various figures not unlike the pictures of the ordinary constellations, but not the same. Thus, a nude man of the was actually there. Near the last, a man in long robes and high cap, standing in a circle and addressing two shaggy beings who hovered outside, was described as a star named Magus, a character unfamiliar to Humphreys. Reader's note, a star named Magus is a star named the Mage of Xerxes, King of Persia. End of reader's note. The scheme of the whole, indeed, seems to be an assembly of the patriarchs of evil, perhaps not uninfluenced by a study of Dante. Humphreys thought it an unusual exhibition of his great-grandfather's taste, but reflected that he had probably neglected up in Italy, and had never taken the trouble to examine it closely. Certainly, had he set much store by it, he would not have exposed it to winter weather. He taps a metal, it seemed hollow and not very thick, and turning from it, addressed himself to his plan. After half an hour's work, he found it was impossible to get on without using a clue, so he procured a roll of twine from Tusserum and laid it out along the alleys from the entrance to the center, finding the ends to the rim of the top of the globe. This expedient helped him to set out a rough plan before luncheon, and in the afternoon he was able to draw it in more neatly. Towards tea time, Master Cooper joined him and was much interested in his progress. "Now this," said Mr. Cooper, laying his hand on the globe and then drawing it away hastily. "Whew! Holds the heat, doesn't it? You're surprising me, Grady, Mr. Humphreys. I suppose this metal, copper, isn't it, would be an insulator or conductor or whatever they call it. The sun has been pretty strong this afternoon," said Humphreys, evading the scientific point. "But I didn't notice the globe had got hot. No, it doesn't seem very hot to me," he added. "Odd," said Mr. Cooper. "Now I can't hardly bear my hand on it. Something in the difference of temperament between us, I suppose. I dare say you're a cheery subject, Mr. Humphreys. I'm not, and that's where the distinction lies. All this summer I've slept, if you'll believe me, practically in statu quo, and had my morning tub as cold as I could get it, day out and day in. Let me assist you with that string." "It's all right, thanks, but if you'll collect some of these pencils and things that are lying about, I should be much obliged. Now, I think we've got everything, and we might get back to the house." They left the maze, Humphreys rolling up the clue as they went. The night was rainy. Most unfortunately, it turned out that, whether by Cooper's fault or not, the plan had been the one thing forgotten the evening before. As was to be expected, it was ruined by the wet. There was nothing for it but to begin again. The job would not be a long one this time. The clue, therefore, was put in place once more, and a fresh start made. But Humphreys had not done much before an interruption came in the shape of Carlton with a telegram. His late chief in London wanted to consult him. Only a brief interview was wanted, but the summons was urgent. was a brilliant moonlit night. In a few weeks' time, the sonorous winds of autumn would break up all this calm. But now the distant woods were in a deep stillness. The slopes of the lawns were shining with dew. The colors of some of the flowers could almost be guessed. The light of the moon just caught the corners of the tent and the curve of its leaden fur. When Humphrey touched her own, but so soon, these conceits of a past age have a real beauty. In short, the light, the perfume of the woods, and the absolute quiet called up such kind old associations in his mind that he went on ruminating them for a long, long time. As he turned from the window, he felt he had never seen anything more complete of its sort. The one feature that struck him with a sense of incongruity was the small Irish yew, thin and black, which stood out like an outpost of the shrubbery through which the maze was approached. That, he thought, might as well be a way. The wonder was that anyone should have thought it would look well in that position. However, next morning, in the press of answering letters and turning over books with Mr. Cooper, the Irish yew was forgotten. One letter, by the way, arrived this day, which has been mentioned. It was from that lady Wardrop, whom Miss Cooper had mentioned, and it renewed the application which he had addressed to Mr. Wilson. He pleaded, in the first place, that he was about to publish a book of mazes, and earnestly desired to include the plan of the Woolsthorpe maze, and also that it would be a great kindness if Mr. Humphreys could let me see it, if at all, at an early date, since she would soon have to go abroad for the winter months. Her house at Bentley was not far distant, so Humphreys was able to send a note by hand to her, suggesting the very next day, or the day after, for her visit. It may be said at once that a messenger brought back a most grateful answer, to the effect that the morrow would suit her admirably. The only other event of the day was that the plan of the maze was successfully finished. This night, again, was fair and brilliant and calm, and Humphreys lingered almost as long at his window. The Irish yew came to his light again as he was on the point of drawing his curtains, but either he had been misled by a shadow the night before, or else the shrub was not really so obtrusive as he had fancied. Anyhow, he saw no reason for interfering with it. What he would do away with, however, was
Many things.
You can have that tomorrow. I wish you could help me to a solution of my block puzzle. What? Those stones in the summer house? That is impossible. They are in no sort of order. Of course not. But the man who put them down must have had some directions. Perhaps you'll find a paper about it among your uncle's things. If not, you'll have to call in somebody who's an expert in ciphers. Advise me about something else, please, said Humphreys. That bush thing out of the library window, you would have that away, wouldn't you? Which? That? Oh, I think not, said the lady wardrobe. I can't see it very well from this distance, but it's not unsightly. Perhaps you're right. Only looking out my window just above it last night, I thought it took up too much room. It doesn't seem to as one sees it from here, certainly. Very well. I'll leave it alone for a bit. Tea was the next business. Soon after which, Lady Wardrop drove off. But halfway down the drive, he stopped the car and beckoned to Humphreys, who was still on the front door steps. He rang between her parting words, which were, "It just occurs to me, it might be worth your while to look at the underside of those stones. They must have been numbered, mustn't they? Goodbye again. Home, please." The main occupation of this evening, at any rate, was settled. The tracing of the plan for Lady Wardrop, and the careful collation of it with the original, and a couple of hours' work at least. Accordingly, soon after 9, Humphreys had his materials put out in the library, and began. It was a still, stuffy evening. Windows had to stand open, and he had more than one grisly encounter with a bat. These unnoted episodes made him keep a pair of his eye on the window. Once or twice it was a question whether there was not a bat, but something more considerable that had a mind to join him. How unpleasant it would be if someone had slipped noiselessly over the sill and was crouching on the floor. The tracing of the plan was done. It remained to compare it with the original, and to see whether any paths had been wrongly closed or left open. With one finger on each paper, he traced out the course that must be followed from the entrance. There were one or two slight mistakes, but here near the centre was a bad confusion, probably due to the entry of the second or third bat. Before correcting the copy, he followed out carefully the last turnings of the path in the original. These at least were right. They led without a hitch to the middle space. Here was a feature which need not be repeated on the copy. An ugly black spot without a sign of a shilling. Ink? No. It resembled a hole. But how could a hole be here? He stared at it with tired eyes. The work of tracing had been very laborious, and he was drowsy and depressed. But surely this was a very odd hole. It seemed to go not only through the paper, but through the table on which it lay. Yes, and through the floor below that, down and you're a child, you may have pored over a square inch of counterpane until it became a landscape with wooded hills, and perhaps even churches and houses, and you lost all thought of the true size of yourself and it. So this hole seems to Humphreys for the moment the only thing in the world. For some reason it was hateful to him from the first, but he had gazed at it for some moments before a new feeling of anxiety came upon him, and then it did come, stronger and stronger, a horror lest something might emerge from it, and a really agonizing conviction that a terror was on its way, from the sight of which he would not be able to escape. Oh yes, far, far down there was a movement, and the movement was upwards, towards the surface. Nearer and nearer it came, and it was of a blackish grey colour, with more than one dark hole. It took shape as a face, a human face, a burnt human face, and with the odious writhings of a wasp creeping out of a rotten apple, there clambered forth an appearance of a form, waving black arms, prepared to clasp the head that was bending over them. With a convulsion of despair, Humphreys threw himself back, struck his head against a hanging lamp, and fell. There was concussion of the brain, shock to the system, and a long confinement to bed. The doctor was badly puzzled, not by the symptoms, but by a request which Humphreys made to him as soon as he was able to say anything. "I wish you would open the ball in the maze." "Hardly enough room, though, I should have thought," was the best answer he could summon up. "But it's more in your way than mine. My dancing days are over." At which Humphreys muttered and turned over to sleep. And the doctor intimated to the nurses that the patient was not out of the wood yet. When he was better able to express his views, Humphreys made his meaning clear and received a promise that the thing should be done at once. He was so anxious to learn the result that the doctor, who seemed a little pensive next morning, saw that more harm than good would be done by setting up his report. "Well," he said, "I'm afraid the ball was done for. The metal must have worn thin, I suppose. Anyhow, it went all to bits with the first blow of the chisel." "Well, go on, do," said Humphreys impatiently. "Oh, you want to know what he found in it, of course. Well, it was half full of stuff like ashes." "Ashes? What did you make of them?" "I haven't thoroughly examined them yet. There's hardly been time, but Cooper's made up his mind, I dare say from something I said, that it's a case of cremation. Now don't excite yourself, my good sir. Yes, I must allow, I think he's probably right. The maze is gone, and Lady Wardrop has forgiven Humphreys. In fact, I believe he married her niece. She was right, too, in her conjecture that the stones in the temple were numbered. There had been a numeral placed on the bottom. few of these had dropped off, but enough remained to enable Humphreys to reconstruct the inscription. It ran thus: Penetrans ad interiorem mortis. Reader's note: penetrating into the interior places of death. End of reader's note. Grateful as Humphreys was to the memory of his uncle, he could not quite forgive him for having burnt the journals and letters of the James Wilson who had gifted Woolsthorpe with the maze and the temple. As to the circumstances of that ancestor's death and burial, no tradition survived, but his will, which was almost the only record of him accessible, assigned an unusually generous legacy to a servant who bore an Italian name. Mr. Cooper's view is that human